Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Guy.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good. I was wondering this week, lying in bed late at night, thinking of landfill sites and how so much of what we've done in our lives must be sitting in the strata of landfill. And I was thinking about... Right, this is starting well, isn't it?
That's a cheery start.
Well, it's 4 a.m., you know. It's what you think about, isn't it? That and dying. And I was thinking, because some of them said to me, you know, did you keep all your old clothes from the 80s? And the early 80s was the most interesting, you know, sort of designed by sort of St. Martin's School of Art fashion kids, you know, swathes of tartan, etc. And I was thinking, no, I said, no, I sort of put them in black bin liners probably, and they either got dumped or I just took them to Oxfam. What did you do with yours?
I've still got some. I kept sort of like one example of everything, which all fits my son beautifully, and he won't wear it. And I've made him try it on. He wore my Johnson's D-Mob suit in an Ibsen play at school, and he looked magnificent.
Wow, so, the Johnson D-Mob suits were really something to have, weren't they?
Yeah,
and you were a big man on Scott Crowler suits as well, which looked like, you know.
I was huge on Crowler. I've still got some of that. Yeah, I've still got some of the Crowler stuff. Yeah,
like sofa covering. Yeah. But are you waiting for your V&A exhibition? Is that what it is? Where you could have...
Well, of course. Yeah, I mean...
See, I think what's happened is a lot of my clothes...
I think I'm maybe in the village hut down here.
I reckon, because you give them to Oxfam, etc. I reckon if we acted like Stanley and went in search of the source of the Nile, and there's probably some African king wearing my old true suit or something. whatever. Brilliant.
Anyway, but what has this got to do with Bob Ezrin?
Absolutely nothing.
I thought you were going to do something about him.
So this is someone that you've worked with, Bob Ezrin.
But he's Uncle Bob to me. He's the first person who had that mantle that Trevor Horn was to have, which is, if he produced an album, didn't really matter who it was, because you knew it was going to sound amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the first time I remember seeing his name on Alice Cooper album labels. And I think my early association was, if it was Bob Ezrin, it was theatrical and it was big.
Exactly. Absolutely that.
I mean,
exactly. That's why I remember when you finding out that he'd done Pink Floyd, it's just like, oh my God, of course.
Yeah, The Wall. And he co-wrote The Trial, didn't he?
He co-wrote The Trial. Well, he wrote that. We'll cover all that. He basically wrote the script for it. And
we will. So he did.
And he also, it's got to be said, if it wasn't for him, there would be no Comfortably Numb. And I think that counts as an actual service to humanity.
Wow. Every single Alice Cooper album, I think 15 albums he's produced.
He
missed the first two. It has to be said. That was on the Zappa label. Do you remember Frank Zappa had the Alice? We had Alice on. You can go and look up Alice on one of our earlier episodes. He's done Kiss. He's done Aerosmith, Deep Purple. Peter Gabriel won.
Which is still, if you listen to that now, man, it's one of the most perfectly produced records ever.
Well, you wonder if the 80s production sound was invented then in 1977 with Gabriel One. And of course, Lou Reed's Berlin, which actually at the time got a bit sort of, you know, some bad press. But in retrospect, is a superb record.
It's magnificent. Yeah, but at the time, it's a hard listen.
it depends where you are. It depends if it's 4 a.m, you're thinking of landfill sites.
If you're thinking of landfill... Then perhaps children screaming because they're being taken away from their mother isn't so bad.
Okay, on that note, let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
You get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Come in Toronto.
All rise for Bob Ezrin.
Boys, yay! Boys, crazy boys. Hang loose, boys. Got a rocket in my pocket. Stay loosey, loose, boys. Okay.
Uncle Bob. There you are. You're saying that's why we love you, Bob. We were talking about this because you are like us. You're a West End Wendy.
We were saying in our intro that, you know, when I was I won't say a kid, I'll say a young man, and I saw your name on a record, I knew there was going to be a certain amount of theatricality. I mean, Billion Dollar Babies is just drenched in theatricality. Even that opening song. I wanted to ask you about that opening song. Hello, Hooray. Because that's written by a Canadian. Was that something to do with you?
Well, yes. I heard the song
all Canadian songs.
No. The only thing it had to do with me was that I had heard this song, and it was written by a guy by the name of Rolf Kemp, K-E-M-P-F, who at the time was living not far away from Toronto. And I didn't know that. I had heard it on a Judy Collins record, and I thought, whoa, you know, if we took this and made it into a like rock opera, and we changed the lyrics, of course, this would be a tremendous overture for Alice for the next record. So I looked into finding the guy, and it turns out he lived 30 miles away from me. And I approached him with the idea. He was fine with it. And then I pitched it to the band. And surprisingly, they were okay with the idea. You know, I had it in my head already, kind of when I went into the rehearsals with them, as to what the potential of it was. That boom, 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 yeah. Boom, boom. That's like, you know,
yeah.
That's...
And Alice
that's
just sings
Wagnerian, yeah.
But in a way, yeah. It's almost like a precursor to In the Flesh, isn't it?
I guess, yes. It's not so much a precursor to, it's just a through line,
just
you know,
through. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Awesome. Oh, yeah. From the time I first started playing. Well, it's not a bad question. It's a perfectly valid question. I mean, I'll tell you the one thing that is true is that I go into every project forgetting everything I ever learned, not knowing what I did the last time, and just, you know, starting afresh. However, I bring in my sort of natural tendencies, we'll call it that, and some of the, you know, those riffs that are stuck in my head that I can't get rid of that keep showing up. Right. You know, like that kind of stuff. So, right. Yes.
Yeah, but your theatricality is definitely something that we know. We associate you with, whether it's working with Alice or whether it's working with Kiss or on something like The Wall and someone like Roger, you know, who, and pulling off a great big theatrical show like that. You know, I wondered actually thinking about that sound on Billion Dollar Babies and that opening, that triumphal opening. And it Brain Salad Surgery and Emerson, Lake and Palmer had a little bit of a bent towards that.
Oh, totally.
Stuff.
Well, I think all of this comes from, you know, having classical background, and it would have been referred to it in those days as prog, progressive.
Yeah, absolutely. We haven't had that word for a couple of episodes. Good. Well, thanks for bringing it back, Bob.
Well, you know, look, there are moments in history and moments in music that are gentle and sweet and where there is no conflict and there's no, you know, there are no major hills, no major valleys. And then there are moments of explosiveness in history and in the arts, you know. And so rock, you would have to say rock was explosive in its nature as it got louder. Yeah. So a guitar and a drummer in a festival were louder than anything you'd ever heard before in your life, right? So we were into loud, we were into big, we were into powerful, and it was only a matter of time before somebody looked back and went, oh shit, that stuff was pretty heavy. Let's do some of that.
I wonder, you know, was there any, you know, being in the early 70s, was there a sort of East Coast versus West Coast feel where the West Coast had the sort of, you know, the very fey sort of singer-songwriter stuff, and then the East Coast had its rock and its art and its Warhol and Iggy?
That place and that time on the West Coast was really laid back, chill. People were like, you're getting in touch with themselves, you know, and life was beautiful and there was nothing to complain about. Our house is a very, very, very fine house. We're in New York. They're going like, fuck you, buddy. You know, did he get it? I'm going to slit his throat on the pavement and write about it. You know, so.
And I'm going to do it to an overture.
The Troubadour and CBGBs. Kind of.
Go into the Troubadour and just chill with a bunch of your best buds. Everything is cool. And, you know, man. And everybody's a dude. Hey, dude, it's beautiful. And in New York, like, nothing was cool. Everything was tough.
So are you an East Coast producer? Is that what you were?
Well, I grew up in a city, even though many people in the world don't believe it. Toronto's actually a major city. and there are millions and millions of people who live here. And when I was a kid, it was kind of a gritty place. And I spent a lot of time downtown where it was very gritty. And then when I switched to New York to go work, I was at home. New York was just all of that, but on steroids. And I loved the energy of it. And I loved the noise of it. And I loved the impulsion of everything. And that energy fed my work, of course. Yeah. And I moved there like as soon as I could. I was like, get me an apartment.
And where was that? Were you producing by that point?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'd already had.
You were produced really young, didn't you? You sort of accidentally produced or sort of weren't supposed to be producing. So who was it? It was the big Canadian producer shoved you in charge of something.
Jack Richardson. Who may be the greatest Canadian producer ever. Jack saw something in me and I thought, the story is this. Michael Cole and I were co-managing a band. I had been playing in clubs and messing around with folk music and then a little bit of folk rock and that sort of thing on the periphery. I wasn't really in it until Michael Cole and I found this band called Icarus, the lead singer of which was Eddie Schwartz, who wrote Hit Me With Your Best Shot. You guys know very well. Yeah. And not at that time, later, but... So Michael Cole, who ended up becoming the biggest promoter in history before Live Nation.
Yeah, we've just been on tour with him, as you know.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Michael promoted the tour you gentlemen just did with Nick. And, used to promote the Rolling Stones, U2, Pink Floyd, Barbra Streisand, you name it. But back then, we were two teenagers from Toronto. And... he thought managing them meant booking them in clubs. And I thought managing them meant working on their songs, you know, as you do. So that's what we were doing. And then a show came up where there was an opportunity to put a rock and roll band in the show and get them paid. And that looked good to us as managers. So, and I happened to be the script editor of that show. So I convinced the producers to bring Icarus, our band, into the show, put them on stage and pay them. And the music director of the show didn't really know how to deal with those guys. So I just kept doing what I had been doing with them. And I worked on arrangements and stuff like that. The music director came in, Alan McMillan, and sort of, you know, put us in the right places and that sort of stuff. And he liked what I had done. And he said, I want my partner to meet you. He could use somebody like you. I think he was thinking of me as maybe an arranger or an assistant to Jack. So I went in there to talk to Jack about it. And I said, I want to be a manager. I want to work on songs. I want to work on arrangements. I really love bands. He goes, No. You don't want to be a manager. You want to be a producer. And I had no idea what he was talking about. But I said, yes, sir. That's exactly what I want to do. So he offered me a job and I took it. And then he took it on himself to train me. He saw something in me and spent a huge amount of time and personal capital. Like he just, like every moment he had that was free where the two of us were together, he was teaching. This is this kind of microphone. This is where you put that. This is why you do this on a session and why you don't do that. And then he sent me to the Eastman School of Music for 2 weeks for a kind of a course in production and engineering, I guess it was, under Phil Ramone. The legendary Phil Ramone. Yeah. And Phil was a friend of Jack's. They had worked together. So I went down to Rochester, New York, to Eastman School for 2 weeks, and Phil saw something and that he liked. And so he took an interest. And I got a little extra time on consoles. I got a little extra direction. And by the time I left that 2 weeks, I felt like I could do it. Yeah, I felt like I could do it.
Just getting a little bit of the background. Had you classical training? Did you?
Yes.
Been taught as a pianist, or so what was your education in music?
I took piano lessons as a kid, and then I started playing and singing stuff. I mean, we were a kind of all playing, all singing, all dancing family. We were like the Jewish Von Trapps in Toronto, you know. Everybody played and sang and did stuff. My father played stand up bass in a big band to work his way through medical school, and my mother was kind of
love it.
She was a concert pianist who was too shy to play. So we got the concerts. They were all at home. And
what's wrong with you? You didn't become the doctor.
I became the bum. I could have been a bum doctor, but I thought this was a better job. So, but you know, from the time I was little, like my grandfather, who was a song and dance man at night, he was a linotype operator during the day, and he did vaudeville at night. That's started great. Teaching me song and dance routines when I was two. So, you know, we were doing me and my shadow. I was his shadow, and stuff like that. And, you know, for a few years, and then he died when I was five, but not before he had taken me to see a movie called The Greatest Show on Earth with Charlton Heston. And it was a circus movie. And I fell in love. That was it. The switch went on. And I just looked at this and said, that's what I want to do. I didn't know what that was, but I wanted something like that with people applauding and lights and colors and all that excitement. And the music was amazing. So that's how I saw it.
In a way, that's your, when we have people on and their moment is either the Elvis or the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or Bowie on Top of the Pops. That was your Elvis on Ed Sullivan moment.
Yes.
Yeah, but also, Guy, this is everything you're about to do.
Right, because exactly.
I mean, Alice is Gothic Circus, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So that was one of them. There were a few moments. My parents were very into theater and the arts and that sort of stuff. So we would go to the Stratford Festival here in Ontario. And Stratford, Ontario.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought the Shakespeare Festival in Stratford. That would have been impressive.
Yes. Our Stratford Festival our Shakespeare. And we had a lot of your actors come over.
Okay, right.
And do Shakespeare during the summer. It was actually the number one theatrical festival in the summer in all of North America.
Is it still going?
It's been going since the 50s.
We must go.
You must come, yes, yes. Come over. But the theater in which this, you know, where the main is sort of the main stage was Theater in the Round, almost sort of, you know, 240 degrees. And that's it. Just a pallet on the floor. Think when we speak of horses that you see them, their hoofs, you know, and all this stuff from Henry V. But, you know, that's it.
It's your imagination.
It's all imagination.
I want to ask you something about that connects in a way, because you're talking about Henry V there as well, aren't you? When he describes him at
yes.
the beginning.
Oh, for a muse of, of fire that would ascend the brightest heavens of invention. Yes.
Do you prefer walking into a studio with a completely blank page, or do you want to hear those songs all finished?
Oh, no. Walking into the studio, we know what we're doing. Walking into a project with a blank page, yes, I prefer that. But then we go through the process of, you know, look, this is, in a way, it's no different than making a movie. You have to have a script or you're just flailing, and it becomes very time consuming and sometimes incredibly expensive. And don't forget, you know, like at the time that I started, it was the labels that hired me, not the acts themselves. Mm. Now it's different. So the label would say, this is your budget, this is when we need it delivered, and you do that and you get paid. So I had a mandate and had to get things done within a certain period of time. What they didn't dictate was how much time we'd spend on pre-production. For me, that's the key to the making of the record, the pre-production.
Because that does seem to be a thing. Yeah, sorry, but that does seem to be a thing that runs through all of your work, is that you always, before you do a thing or once you're doing it, is you always try and find the story, what the story is. And, you know, a lot of people, Trent Reznor's talked about that. Obviously, with the Wall, you actually wrote a script, right? Which is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I wish I'd known when we went. I've never seen it.
Yeah,
you're right about that, because I mean, obviously, you know, there's a sense that, you know, Billion Dollar Babies has a sense of story about that. Berlin with Lou Reed was definitely an inspiration. You know, took his inspiration from you to finish a story.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Lou always told stories. One of the things that I had said to him when we met the first time was that, you know, you tell a life in 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes, but there's a lot of blanks, and I kind of want to know, you know. You set these amazing characters up for us, and I want to get to know them better. So, and I said, when we first got together, I said, for example, you know, that couple in that song you wrote called Berlin, because Berlin was on an earlier album in a different form. And I said, you know, I would have really loved to have known where did this go, you know, and know more about them. And then we were sitting there and it's like we both had a V8 moment, like, wait a minute, you wrote that song. We don't have to go like Berlin. Let's take that song and extrapolate it out into a full tale, you know, about these two people. And he loved that, because that's where he goes naturally. You know, he sees a person, he sees the situation. He can describe what they're wearing. He can describe the smell of the place that they're standing in and all that stuff in a song. But, you know, you can only do so much in 3 minutes. And if you have a whole album to explore, you can get really deep. So yeah, we did.
We certainly know a lot about that couple by the end of Berlin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I think because you're trying to get the intimacy of Lou, aren't you? You know, you he's almost in the room talking to you. You know, it's a very different approach to production to the one you were doing with Alice.
Right, because the Berlin story was more like a film, and that's in the sense that there really was there was an arc to the story. There was a beginning, you got to know who they were, and then there was this crisis point, and then you get to the end, and so on. And some of it was very, very confessional. And so for the confessional stuff where he's going like, you know, somebody else would have broken both of her arms, you know, like that. He's leaning in and he's telling you, you know what, that bitch, I should have killed her, you know. But there was a certain amount of kind of using Lou, I want to put this in the right way, using Lou in his state at that moment. He was going through a divorce. He was, let's say, you know, partying a little bit, because we were in London and David Bowie and Mick Ronson were around a lot. And they used to take him out after sessions, which is not something that I would normally condone, but, you know, it's David Bowie, for God's sake. So sometimes Lou would come into the studio feeling a little hungover and also emotional, because he would have had a phone call, you know, 20 minutes earlier to talk about splitting up and all that stuff. So he'd come in really, you know, almost wanting to cry. And I would put him on a stool and put the microphone this close and make the sound in his headphones very intimate, so he was really hearing himself. He was hearing every syllable and every mouth noise, and he played it. He used it. He'd slur his words. You know, there was a couple of songs where I said, okay, you know, like the guy's fucked up, don't you think? And so let's play it like that. So he, like, literally, you know, he would start to slur his words a little bit. It was great.
You had a lot to compete with, though, because of Transformer being such a big commercial hit. Was there a record company on your shoulder going, where's Transformer?
The interesting thing is that...
And generally, how do you feel about that pressure?
I had exactly the opposite mandate. Because when Lou came to me, he said he didn't like what happened to him after Transformer. You know, he didn't like being suddenly pigeonholed as a pop star. And he just, you know, he had never been in that milieu. He never wanted to be there. And he wanted to get back to being the tortured artist that he really saw himself as, right? Or just the artist with a capital A. And so he wanted to make an anti-Transformer. And that was my mandate from my partner in crime in the project, Lou Reed, who happened to be the star, right? And so it kind of didn't matter what the record company said. And at that stage, luckily for us, his ex-manager was now the head of A&R at RCA. So there was a lot of sympathy for what he wanted to attempt. And they respected him as an artist. They really did. And he just made him a lot of money. And I think, you know, maybe in the boardroom, somebody was saying, okay, right, you know, let's say it's a throwaway, but if it makes him happy, let's give him this one and then we'll do another commercial one sort of thing. And when it came out, there were two completely opposite reactions to it at the same time. There was a cover of Rolling Stone that said Sgt. Pepper of the 70s, which it's not. But then there was another one which called it the worst piece of depressing crap that they'd ever heard. And I think the audience wasn't quite ready for it yet. They didn't really get it. It did not do well. But over the years, it just kept selling. And then more and more. And then it became like his classic in a certain way, because it was the most completely Lou thing that he had done as a solo project. Mm-hmm. And up until that, you know, till that era. Anyway, so go ahead, guys.
Because you wrote, I wonder if how that was, you know, make it, because it, where it seemed so hard as a record, and, you know, like it was bleak and challenging for people at the time, but it was written as a show, right? And the thing is, but if you're presenting a show like a film or a play or something, you can be darker than people expect from a record.
Yeah, it was a record. I mean, we knew we were making a record. We did want to play it. We wanted to play it live. We could see it. We saw those people. We even had a set in sort of between the two of us. We had designed the concept, and it was going to be a structure that was two stories with two rooms on the bottom and two rooms on the top, two up, two down. And
did you tell Roger about this while you were doing the wall? Because it sounds familiar.
A little bit, right? Yeah. And that we were going to play, you know, Jim would be in this room while Caroline would be here. They'd be together there. There'd be somebody there. But it was a two-hander. And we, you know, with sound effects and all that sort of stuff. And we saw it that way. We really wanted to take it out like that. But the reaction commercially was so sort of tepid that, you know, there wasn't the momentum to be able to force something like that into existence.
Just go back to meeting Alice.
Well, I just wanted to say one last thing on Berlin before we do that.
Yeah, sorry,
which is because I saw the show when, of course, Lou finally got to do it.
Yeah.
But it's funny what you say about the set, because I think, was it Julian Schnabel who designed the set? And it was quite a big deal, because I remember going to the Hammersmith Apollo.
Wow.
And the set looks incredible. And there's a sofa upside down, and there's various bits, and there's all these wires everywhere. And you're thinking, this is going to be amazing. I wonder what it's going to do. Because it's like when you go to a Floyd show and there's all these wires, you go, wow, shit's going to happen. But nothing happens.
Nothing happens.
With the set. It's just an upside-down sofa with a wire coming off it.
So, Julian Schnabel who is a very famous fine artist and
director.
And director. That's yeah. You're absolutely right.
Film
director and exceptional wearer of pajamas at the most inappropriate times.
and a man of a huge ego. I think we all know that.
Do you think? So Julian, one night, Lou and I were having dinner at Wolsey in New York in the village, just south of his apartment. And Julian came in and saw us sitting there, and he came over to the table. He got on his knees and he just said, please, please, let's do Berlin Live. And he said, you don't understand. Berlin is the reason I'm a painter. That's what started me out and all this stuff. And he actually lit the spark, right? We didn't do it right away, right after that, but we talked about it. Like after he left and sat down with his friends, and then Lou and I were left alone, I was like, you know, maybe it's time now. You know, it's been so long. And Lou said, yeah, maybe it is. And then it went another year or two before we got a call from St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn, which is a, you know, sort of an avant-garde theater, very forward-thinking, very experimental, and
off Broadway,
off, and but highly respected.
Right.
And the artistic director of St. Anne's is very highly respected within the New York arts community, and she called somebody, Lou's management, I guess, and said, you know, we would really like to do Berlin Live, if you don't mind. Now, maybe Schnabel planted the seed, I don't know, but they called, and then that's when it started to happen. So, in fact, Schnabel came up to Toronto, and I happened to be in Toronto at the same time. He was doing something at the Art Gallery of Ontario and doing a talk. So we met at the hotel, we talked about the show and sort of what it could be. And then the ball started to roll. It was a little slow at first, but then it started to take off. The fact is, we didn't create a show. We just played the record.
Can we do Alice now? Can we think about it? And I guess it was your first. No,
I'm kidding. Oh, God, go ahead. Jesus. Whatever you want to do. It's anything you'd like.
I mean, love it to death. So in a way, you know, that conversation we were having earlier about West Coast versus East Coast, in a way, Alice kind of did the runner, didn't he? Or he got kicked out of the West Coast because he was Frank Zappa's boy down in Laurel Canyon, those first two albums, and then made it to Detroit and sort of all changed when he met you, really.
Well, yes, I think it all changed when he found Detroit. That was the beginning of the change. As Shep and Alice both tell in their books, that they couldn't get arrested in Los Angeles, literally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were trying. Alice was outrageous, and they was known for being outrageous and clearing rooms, but they were trying to get more and more notice. They were trying to get some real press. They were trying to get the papers to cover it, the, you know, television to do something. So Shep came up with a great idea. He said, we're going to dress you in see-through plastic costumes. On stage, you'll be naked underneath. You go on stage, I'm going to call the police and say my underage kid is in the club and it's lewd and it's terrible and they need to go down and do something. And so they did, and he did.
The Keystone Cops arrived, right?
By the time the Keystone Cops had arrived, the condensation inside a plastic suit, which is natural anyway, had fogged them up completely. There was nothing to see. So they couldn't even get arrested. Literally.
Magnificent!
Yeah.
Love that.
Oh, it's a great story.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
Bob, I'm going to steer your brain back into I'm 18, right? Okay. Because I'm 18, broke Alice, and it's still, you know, it's one of his great pieces. He still does it. How do you get away? I'd love that, wouldn't you? It's like singing.
Let's hope I die before I get old, isn't it?
My generation.
Yeah.
You know, the great thing about the Alice Cooper songs is that they're all little pieces of theater too. So it's almost as though he's doing he's doing a show, like many, you know, and Gary, you would know this better than any of us, you know, like you go and you do a show and you play it every night for some period of time on stage. And every night you find a little something different. You find, you know, there's something in it that you notice or something in it that you do slightly differently that keeps it alive for you and keeps it interesting. In his case, you know, every night it's a different audience and every night the audience reacts in a slightly different way. And that fuels him. Like he loves, you know, Alice is a true showman, obviously, and loves the applause and loves the interchange with the audience. And so he's been playing a lot of these songs for 50 years, longer. I mean, I'm 18. They already had that when I went to see them at Max's Kansas City on September 8th in 1970. They had already been playing it for a year. I thought it was I'm Edgy when I saw the show because I'm 18 and I don't know what I want. I'm 18 and I'm going, I'm edgy. Ooh, that's hip. So I told them I thought that would be a big song. I love that I'm Edgy song. And they look at each other like, what? Oh, I'm 18. Yes. Even better.
And of course it went on to be, that was the song that John Lydon sang in Along to the Jukebox in Malcolm Vivian's shop that got him the gig with the Sex Pistols. So it's,
that's right.
Bookends the 70s.
Yeah, it does. And it's a good song.
But where did you, but that album and Killer, you know, I mean, they are more just they're rock, straight up glam rock and roll. But then something begins to happen with him, with School's Out, I guess. And of course, School's Out, what a record. I mean, I remember that, you know, and that album cover. Christ, Guy, did you have that album cover?
Of course I had that album,
but
I remember, it was not. But I was still at primary school, but I remember it was those
records
that made me first aware of the idea of record production, you know, because they sounded magnificent, which, I mean, going on to, I mean, Welcome to My Nightmare was the one that's when you suddenly think, oh my God, what is going on here? Just in terms of sound.
But Guy, can I say, I hid those.
You're going to show them to us now, aren't you?
Mum and Dad,
you're going to show them to us now, aren't you?
I didn't know. I don't have them with me. I don't.
He's wearing them.
They stopped putting them on the cover because they were a fire hazard. They were a fire hazard. They were so hot. That was true.
It is. They were a fire hazard and
Basically, for people who don't know, times, it was a school
simpler
desk.
Simpler times. You could give away panties. They could be a fire desk. Hazard. You, I mean, there was, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you lifted up the desk, inside was the record with panties wrapped, paper panties wrapped around.
Yeah.
Even the word makes me feel odd.
It's okay. But I'll tell you what it does. The word panties and paper panties in particular, is it points out that you need a pop filter. Just saying.
I do. Thank you, producer.
Have you done that before? Have you done that before, Bob? Is that a thing? Because that was way too smooth.
Just came up.
Yeah. That's why you get the bit.
But I suppose, yeah, developing Alice's theatrical sound with those boys. Was it, there was a moment when you said, you know what, we don't need to just make all this music with you, with the band. We can start orchestrating this. We can add stuff.
Well, use other musicians. Well, you know, let's back up a little bit, because there was theatricality there was Black Juju on Love It to Death, which was a remarkable piece it was a little bit like Walk on Gilded Splinters, you know, Dr. John. It was creepy and weird, and you know, and there were, he stopped and he yelled and he did all kinds of strange things, and so that was a sort of foray into it. And then and of course Dead Babies later, you know, had a great deal of theater. But on Killer, you know, we had the whole long, you know, Halo of Flies long theatrical piece there, you know. So we were starting to experiment. Then we get to Schools Out. The interesting thing about Schools Out was we had changed studios. Up until Schools Out, I was Jack Jr. I was working in Jack's favorite studio with Jack's favorite engineer, in Jack's way, with Jack's kind of sound, sort of. I was, you know, I mean, only Jack was Jack, but I had learned drum sounds from Jack Richardson. I was using the mics he preferred and all that sort of stuff. Then I get to New York at the Record Plant, which is this incredible crucible of creativity, just a bunch of wacko young men playing with toys. You know, suddenly all this new technology, and there were a few of them that were inventing the technology at the time. So we get there and suddenly, whoa, the sounds are different. You can do all kinds of things that I couldn't do at RCA Mid-America Studios in Chicago at number one North Wacker. Also, there were people on the staff at the Record Plant who played instruments. So I could like me, right? So suddenly I could add a piano, me, and I could add a dulcimer, and that would be Paul Prestipino. And he would come in and play. He was one of the maintenance guys, but he played, you know, a great sort of mandolin, dulcimer, whatever it was that we had him do. Also in New York, you could rent anything. So I could rent a Calliope, which I used on the Kiss, you know, album for Flame and Youth, you know, they died. But I was like, wait, people will talk about this forever.
So Kiss. This is So Kiss.
Yeah, also, no, it wasn't. Yeah.
I've just learned how to say that.
Calliope.
Yes.
You thought it was a Calliope.
I was never quite sure. You only ever see it written down. You're the first person that
we're even, because
say
I always,
it out loud.
I always thought the girl's name was Pennylope. So, you know.
Yeah. Kiss. I mean, they, you know, we had Paul on the show. He seems like a sweetheart. But the other guy.
Well, Alan, isn't this your classic line of shouting, "Who knew?" at a record company meeting? Wasn't that to do with Beth?
Beth. There's a long story to Beth and how that happened.
Is it too long? Is it too boring for you?
The condensed version is that it was important that Peter Criss have a song on the album. This is something that he had written with a friend of his, Stan Pendridge, earlier, and he brought it in. It was a little more, it was sort of cock and balls, you know, kind of arrogant guy saying, basically, screw you, you know, I'm not coming home. Me and the boys are more important and all that stuff. And it was a little bit bouncy. And so I said, can I take it home and play with it a little bit? And I went back to my apartment on 52nd Street, and I sat at my piano, and I don't know where it came from, but bling, blah, da, do, 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 just came out. So now I started to play that, and then I started to sing the song, and I thought, this is, you know, this is actually a very sad song that, you know, why isn't he coming home? And he knows he's breaking her heart. Why, what's going on? And the fact is that his house no longer feels like a home, and he just can't. So it's really his heart that's broken, her heart that's broken. It's a sad story of the breakdown of a relationship. And, you know, and he ends it by saying, you know, Beth, I hear you calling and I hope you'll be all right, but me and the boys will be playing all night. I'm not coming home, is basically what he's saying. Mm-hmm. And so, so we made it into a ballad, a really kind of sensitive, sad ballad. And Peter just happens to have this kind of, that smoky voice that lent itself to the song perfectly in that form.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did it like that. And the minute we did it, like, I just knew that that was a hit. But the rest of the band didn't feel like it was representative of Kiss. And it wasn't, you know, not at the time, wasn't representative of Kiss as people knew them, but it was representative of the Kiss of Destroyer. Because the purpose of Destroyer, from my point of view, was to take them from being a cock and balls rock band that appeals to 15-year-old pimply boys and no one else. They would never not going to be cartoonish as long as they were all dressed up like that. But you know, when we first met, I said to them, you know, there's a famous movie in the 50s called The Wild One with
Marlon Brando
and Lee Marvin. They were two warring motorcycle clubs, mm-hmm. bad guys, all bad guys. The thing is that Lee Marvin was a monochromatic, dressed in black, bad, bad, bad guy, and you just hate.
Was it one a gang called the Beatles? Have I got that right? Was one gang, one of the gangs had a name of a band.
Interesting. I don't remember that. But Lee Marvin was just nasty. Whereas Marlon Brando, there was something about him that was a little vulnerable, a little more humane. And the girl, the pretty daughter of somebody important, who was, you know, tightly wound, good Christian, lovely girl, you know, virgin, whatever. She saw something in Johnny, Marlon Brando's character, that she fell in love with. And
what
she
are you rebelling against? What do you got?
Exactly.
It's a rock and roll line.
That's it. So I said to them, right now you're Lee Marvin. And that's a glass ceiling. We'll never go wide with that. It'll just be the 15-year-old boys that go, oh, that's cool. But what we want is we want to expand to where every girl in America looks at you guys and goes, I can fix that. I love him and I'm going to fix him. Because that's what girls do. They look at people like you, Gary, and you, Guy, and they say, I love him. I can fix that.
Well,
that was a very
Chris
nervous
Martin
laugh
said,
there.
You know?
Chris Martin says, no, that's where Chris Martin got it all wrong. He said, I can fix you.
That album was both the macho, sort of, you know, straight up sexual side of them. It was also a little bit of mystery, and it was a lot of vulnerability that people didn't pick up on at the very first, but it was in there. And Do You Love Me and Great Expectations, even though it was Great Expectations was full of bravado.
And then they go and call it Destroyer and ruin it all.
Sorry, Gary. What were you saying?
How did you two guys meet?
I first met Bob when you came to... Well, I wanted to do Peter Gabriel, but we'll do that afterwards. I first met you when you were brought to, and I was in a totally overwhelmed state at the time, when we were rehearsing that Pink Floyd tour in Toronto Airport, and we were in trouble, right? And it was like 2 weeks before the first show, and you were brought in to sort of fix the show.
Right. David called me. David is fantastic, and I love him. We've remained close friends through... Yeah. You know, from the time that I first met him on the wall and stuff. And we worked on a couple of other things. We worked on his solo album, and we worked on obviously the two post-Roger records. And to a certain extent, I was kind of on the last.
Endless Rhythm.
Yeah, Endless Rhythm, the last.
You played bass on it, you bastard.
Yes. Yes, I did.
What? Well, I used to play bass on the Division Bell sessions quite a lot when they couldn't be bothered to get me in.
You know, in several of these instances, he would start out trying to do it alone, and then he would get to a point and he would phone me and say, you know, do you think you could come in and I might need a little bit of help here. You know, that was the thing on the solo record. And then by the time we got to Momentary Lapse of Reason tour, the call was, I never failed to try to do it on my own. And I rarely fail to notice that I can't. I need some help. So would you please come and work on this thing? It was so sweet. It was just the sweetest thing. And he was like
I was so glad you're there. But what I would say, because like in David's defense, David, I mean, he's more than capable as a band leader. And that's,
absolutely,
he loves that. But it's the show, right?
Reality is you can't be on stage and watching the stage at the same time. You can't.
Yeah.
No. It's impossible.
But plus played together for years. Nick was unsure of himself. Rick was very much still in his shell. You had all these new kids, you know, it was.
Yeah. Well, there was all of that too, but that's the kind of stuff that I think David could have handled on his own. And he did a pretty good job getting it up to that point, but it wasn't gelling and the flow of the show was not there. I didn't like when I came in and watched it, I didn't like the lighting. I didn't like, you know, I just thought that it was everything all the time.
But does it begin with the set list and the structure? Like,
yes,
you said,
of course, you know, there has to be an arc to the experience, right? You have to start off with a bang. You have to keep people going and keep them up and moving, and then there's an appropriate point at which to bring it down if you wish, and then you can start introducing all kinds of other things. But it was when to do it that was important.
Well, there are two things you said in those rehearsals, by the way, which I'm going to say, which have stayed with me the rest of my whole life. One was at one point you were on stage being very brilliant, shouting very much like a theatre director, shouting at everyone. You said, if you're lost, if you don't know what's going on, if you're stuck in the song, look at Guy. He always knows what's going on. I was like, what? Which is A, just completely untrue, and B, the most terrifying thing I ever heard. The other thing you said, which is, and it's a phrase that I still use to this day, which was that, because Nick was a bit unsure of himself and concerning himself a lot with the logistics of the show and stuff. And also, I think, perhaps slightly intimidated by Gary, as was I.
Not me,
no,
by
not
the way.
You, Gary Wallace, the very, very brilliant, you know, proper, top-notch session percussion drummer. And it was literally... We're getting right near the end, and Nick still wasn't in his groove. And you said to me, Nick, you said, don't worry, come the hour, the curtain goes up, and you will see Nick Mason, boy drummer. And we did, and have ever since. And I always love it. And I always think of Nick as Nick Mason, boy drummer, because of that.
Wow. Yeah, that was my nickname for him, Nicky. But I
always see a show, Bob, as generally the way to what the audience want from a show is this. You arrive, the band come on stage, and they are greater human beings. They are coming deus ex machina from the sky, and you want to look up and see this power, this energy. And then during the show, what happens is you join them, and you become one. They come down, you go up, you know, but there's a leveling out within the auditorium.
That's very poetic. I like it.
Great.
You don't we'll keep it. Worry. But,
well, yeah, love it, can't use it, save it for your solo album. I want to talk to you because
this is a side project I've got going.
But Peter Gabriel, right? Because when you work with him, because Bob, what an album. I mean, that's one of the most important records of my life. So here's a guy who's come out of Genesis who was all about total theatricality, but where was he when you. Because none of us knew what to expect from a Peter Gabriel record. Where was he when he came to work with you? And it's like, was he wanting more of his theatricality, or was he trying to get away from that? Or
good question.
It is a good question. My recollection is that he was coming out of Genesis. He was very nervous about going out on his own. But, you know, very much like this is Peter's nature. Peter is driven, even though he looks like the calmest and sort of most laid back guy you've ever met. There is an inner fire that is lit all the time and that pushes him along a route, whether he likes it or not. And he's driven by a notion. He gets a notion in his head and he cannot let go of it. So regardless of the fact that it may frighten him to death. So, you know, the idea of leaving, like, how do you leave a band like Genesis? They're just breaking. They're just like becoming the most important prog band in the world at the time. And people are recognizing him for the brilliant talent that he is. Something in him said, I'm not getting, my true voice is not being heard and I need to go. So he went. Even before, it's like he leapt over the cliff without knowing what was on the other side.
I wish you'd produced The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Yeah, could you imagine that, though? I mean, it's made for you. Anyway, moving on.
So, you know, when I got called, I guess I was already known for a certain level of theatricality. And also, I think the word had traveled that I was kind of, like camp counselor. You know, I was a good guy for wrangling artists who may have been confused or who had opposing views and stuff like that. I was good at sort of bringing everybody together and defining a direction. And so that's why they called me, because they said, you know, he really needs help. He needs somebody. But we were the same age. I'm actually a year younger than him. And so when we got together, we bonded like brothers, right? I didn't come at him as a, you know, fat controller. I came at him, to quote another artist, yeah. I came at him as a peer and a contemporary, but somebody who really cared about him, which I did. Like, from the first time I met the guy, I just fell in love with him. And I really felt like it was my job to advocate for him, to try and, you know, make his dreams come true and try and create something with and for him that would be very successful and would justify this move that he had made, that people were questioning all over the place. So, that was it. We got together like that. He was a little unsure. And we talked a lot about what the show would be before we made the album, which is really interesting because that's what he's about.
Because you worked him hard, right? There's some. I've heard you talk about this on other things, about like strapping him between pillars and stuff.
Not between, to a pillar.
To a pillar. Oh, I thought it was two pillars. I thought it was the full.
No, one pillar. There were two pillars, like, but I strapped him to this one. okay. Look, it was a joke.
The second one was a threat if he didn't get it right.
Yeah, it was a joke. I said, you know, you get three more tries, and if you don't get it, you're going up the pillar. Because we were big on gaffer tape in those days. We did amazing creative things with gaffer tape. so anyway, he didn't get it. And Brian Christian, the engineer, is a big man from Southside Chicago, massive arms, big muscles and stuff. And I go, let's put him up the pillar. So Brian lifted him in the air. And Jim Frank, who was the engineer from the studio, came over and got a ladder and gaffer taped him under his armpits. So he was stuck to the pillar, and then Brian let him go and he was dangling like this, you know, with his arms flopping. And I said, mic him. So, and then we put headphones on him and stuck a mic in front of him and we ran the thing. And you know, the chorus for Modern Love is, oh, the pain, modern love can be a strain. Well, believe me, he got it on the next take. So that was that. And he was a great sport about it. He was, you know, his arms and legs were flailing as he was singing. And it became like, it was as theatrical as the song called for. Yeah. And he laughed and we laughed. It was terrific. I'll tell you one other thing about Gaffer Tape and Peter Gabriel. Yeah. So we saw that he and Gaffer Tape were, you know, they seemed to get along very well. So one day, as you do, we taped him to a chair with rollers on it, and we wheeled him out to the street and left him there. And then we went back to the studio and we all laughed. Ha ha ha. He's, you know, let's see how he gets back in. And so, and he didn't come back. And then we got really nervous. And so we went out to look for him. He was rolling down the street as he was going, asking people directions. Excuse me,
which way to the, you know, like he's gaffer taped to a chair. Oh, cars are going by and stopping. Are you okay? So, yes, no problem. Can you tell me where the pub is, please? You know, and he's rolling down the road. He was fantastic.
Can I offer up that image of Peter tied to the pillar? I mean, that is Odysseus facing the sirens, isn't it? I mean, that's fantastic stuff.
In a way, yes.
The opposite, with him singing instead of them. But you put together an incredible band. I mean, this was like the real sort of art house London, British scene. You know, I mean, Eno's not on it, of course, but Fripp's on it, and Tony Levin and Larry Fast, of course. I mean, this is almost the future of where music's going. I was saying to Guy earlier, it almost sounds like sound of 80s production. Record,
almost.
In 77.
Those were New Yorkers.
Yeah.
He said, could I please have a Brit? And I said, yeah, sure, you get one. And he chose Fripp, who went on to undermine me towards the end of the project. And it's okay. You know, it's certainly not Fripp the first time it's ever happened. Reasons. But, you know, during the, you know, Fripp, so these
Fripp's
were my
gonna Fripp.
These were my guys and people that I had used on many sessions for other people before. So I knew Tony Levin. I had Tony Levin played on Berlin.
That's right, yeah.
On the Kids. Maybe one other, I can't remember. But, you know.
Was this the first time Tony and Fripp had played together?
Yes, that's where they met.
So you brought them together?
Yeah.
And I love, and of course, what I love is that Tony's still there and very much part of the package, which is why I'm really pleased that he ended up not doing the Pink Floyd gig, and I did, because he never would have been able to be really associated. You know, he always would have been, because he's the guy who does everything. He does the Stickmen, he does Crimson, he has all these wonderful things, but he's, you know, and he's Tony, and I adore Tony. I know Tony, I love him to bits, and he's my hero. But he's that guy, and that thing he has with Peter is so lovely. And
oh, totally. Peter fell in love with him. And during the making of the record, you know, Tony, this is really cool because we did pre-production, which was amazing. And one day when you have more time, I'll tell you the story of pre-production with that, with Peter Gabriel.
Love that.
You know, so we got to Toronto to the studio, the soundstage, which was Nimbus 9 studio. And the band got together. This was the first time everybody came in from their various places. And then we would all sit in Jack's office. Jack wasn't around at the time. I think he was doing the Guess Who. So we'd sit in Jack's office. He had an upright piano. Peter would play the piano. And some of these changes are really complicated. And some of the time changes and things like that on these songs. And the guys would be writing feverishly. Could you go back? Could you go back? You know, he'd play it so they could hear it. And then let's go back to the beginning and let's walk through it so we all understand the structure. He'd play it once and Tony would read a book. That's it. He had it. He already had it. And everybody else is like, could I hear that? You know, that chorus, like one more time, like Tony had it. And at first it was a joke. It was like, are you listening? And then, you know, we'd get into the studio and Tony would have it. I mean, he would play it like he was ready all the time. And then he became kind of a little bit of a leader, too. So he would help people to understand some of these passages. And then when we got to Excuse Me, which
Tony loves a bit of barbershop, doesn't he?
So Tony was in a barbershop quartet. And I don't remember who came up with the idea, but one of us said, it would be great if this was a barbershop quartet. And Tony goes, and he arranged it and the band members sang it. I didn't go out and get ringers. It was the guys who played the instruments on the record that sang the parts in the barbershop quartet. It was amazing. And we would practice outside of the studio in the courtyard. People would come out of their offices, you know, just listening because it was so crazy. Yeah. And on our closing dinner, I hosted a dinner for everybody, closing dinner, and I gave everybody a gift because it was such an amazing experience and they had all given of themselves beyond anything that one could have expected. And so we stood up and did Excuse Me for the restaurant. And because I'd give, well, first of all, I gave Tony a tuba. That was his gift. because he could play the tuba, and he played the tuba.
Of course
on
he could.
Yeah. So he played, and I go, 3, 4, you know, me. And they all stood up and they did their parts, and the restaurant erupted into applause. I said, we're here every Tuesday and Thursday, 2 shows, no waiting, you know, like, and so, but we ended up having the greatest time that night. Wow. Everybody sort of joined in the celebration.
As a little, just a tiny little side note, sorry, Gary, is that, you know, that Tony actually wrote a full barbershop piece where he just names every drummer he's ever worked with.
That's fantastic.
Brilliant thing.
Guy teased me earlier because we were obviously mentioning The Wall, and he said that he felt that Comfortably Numb.
Well, the fact
really
it's because of you that Comfortably Numb exists, which counts as a service to humanity, I would say.
Well, that's very cool.
How true is that, Bob?
It's true. It's true because
we need something in D. It's that, right? I mean, that's
the script to which you referred. The script was, yeah. I treated it like a movie, an eyelid movie. This was not the script for the ultimate film. This was a different thing, but it was a, you know, as if you were watching a movie in your mind, and this was the soundtrack to it. So I described sound effects and so on, and what the action was, you know, that this was a baby cries and we're talking about this. And I put in the lyrics from the songs that we had up until that point. There were a number of empty spots, right? And when we got to the place where Comfortably Numb needed to be, the story we had to tell, this was the breakdown, the ultimate breakdown. And this is where Pink goes into the hole. So I needed a song in D, and it needed to be about the breakdown.
Because you wanted that D chord to hit right at that moment after the proceedings.
Correct.
Song.
I mean, part of the, you know, that listen, part of
the Wall is not short of songs in D, by the way.
No, but we already had a bunch. But yeah, but part of good sequencing is to make sure that the keys between songs change dramatically or don't change, because you don't want them to. Yeah. So yes, we had a lot of songs in D, but that one needed to be in D to start off. And actually it starts off in B minor. So,
right.
But it's relative. Yeah. It's the relative minor, and it worked great. I mean, the intro, as soon as it starts happening, you're captivated. But anyway, so I said, I need a song in D, and David started to play that high string figure, and he had a song. I can't even remember what the song was at the time, but the high string
It was a leftover from hit that he started for his solo album.
Correct.
His first solo.
Correct. Yeah. It was just something he had in his back pocket. And
what is that part of the song? There is no
It's that part. That's the chorus, yes. The chorus of the song, and I believe that melody existed. Da 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 da. And he had that beautiful high string part. And the minute I heard it, I'm like, yes, that's our Hitler. No, that's our song.
Hey, don't
name the reference.
The producers.
Absolutely.
I thought we had Kanye on the show for a second.
We'll get to that before we finish. But
yes, Corey, Comfortably Numb.
No, so that was it. You know, we heard that, and then I threw it to Roger to say, you know, we're going to need some lyrics here, and would you do it? He was resistant at first because he wasn't really welcoming of other people's material to start off with, but as it grew.
That wasn't going to happen at all, was it? The brief was it was no one else.
No, that was not going to happen, but I insisted on certain songs, you know, Run Like Hell and things like that. They were just, we needed them.
Thank God you did.
But did Roger write the verse?
He did.
As we know it.
No, the lyrics, not the music.
I don't know who came up with the B minor progression. Honestly, I don't remember whether that was part of what David had already written, or whether that was something that Roger appended to the David part. Doesn't matter, but it ends up being...
I think I've heard a demo. Yeah, I mean, not that it matters.
I would love to hear that. But
I mean, David's very humble about the solo, and he says, look, you know, I'm playing a blues solo over some great chord sequences, which make the solo sound even better. But I'm sure that, I mean, obviously that's extraordinarily humble.
Come on.
But yeah, I just want you to tell us, as a witness, I mean, there are two solos on that. The first one's very, very melodic. Well, everyone's really always super impressed by the last one, quite rightly. And I just wondered what you remember.
Well, okay. So again, here, Fog of Time. I remember being in the room, excuse me, when he played that for the first time on our guide track. Because we made guide tracks where, it's a long story, but...
there's a very brilliant thing you did, which was all the bass and drums were recorded on 16 track. And correct. Then put onto two tracks of a 24-track tape. The 16 tracks were then put away. The bass and drums had never been played again until you mixed it. So
until we started to mix
oxide.
It.
Yeah.
Correct. Which so we weren't polishing the tape and we weren't rubbing away all the transients and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, we used to record like that in the 80s. But obviously it was a Bob Ezrin idea. That we all stole.
Well, I don't know whether it was my idea, but it was something that I learned on Peter Gabriel, as a matter of fact, and excuse me, and it was something that I was very aware of because as we were overdubbing on all these records, they were starting to get softer sounding, and I didn't understand why. And then I studied the physics of it a little bit, and it became really apparent to me what was happening, that every time you bounce. So every time you went through that process of taking sound, turning it into an electrical impulse, putting it in through this magnet, essentially, that sticks it on tape, and then taking it back off that thing, when it goes through the magnet, there's a little bit of a delay, a tiny, tiny bit of a delay on whatever comes first. And in sound, what comes first is the sharp stuff. So it takes the transient, like the ping of a cymbal or the smack of a snare, takes that transient and just micro, you know, infinitesimally moves it slightly back. And the more you keep doing it, the more you keep copying these things, the more the transient moves back. So I started to learn to do stuff backwards. In other words, if I was going to bounce something down or copy it, I would turn the tape over because in the same way, now it's going backwards, that delay was actually pushing the transient back forward. So anyway, and then it became clear that the best thing to do would be to have, you know, separate machines and just keep the rhythm section pristine and everything else, the overdubs would be on different machines. It's a long story. And we broke a lot of ground technically on that record. And I scared them to death with some of that because they didn't believe it was going to work, you know. And when it finally did, they were like, "Wow!" Because it sounded so good. I'll tell you, comfortably numb. We were down to the last overdub on the 24 track we had, which had all the overdubs on it. We had mixed down the orchestra, we had mixed down this other stuff, put it on a 24 tracks, and there was one thing I wanted to add, and I don't remember what it was, whether it was a tambourine or something, and the only track that was not being used was the now mono bounce of bass and drums that we were playing to. And I said, "Erase it." And everybody's like, "No!" You know, like, "Oh my God, bass and drums, no!" I said, "It's okay, we got it, you know, erase it." And so we did, and it was like heart attack time. And then when the machines actually did sync up, it was amazing. It was like, it was glorious to hear, but everybody was relieved, you know. Wow. So
anyway,
there you
but
go.
that solo is famously first take, isn't it? I mean,
That solo is according to in the history according to Ezrin, first take, and David remembers it the same way. However, I've been chastised by the engineer James Guthrie on the gig, who is very cross with me because apparently I'm stealing his thunder, and actually it was done over several takes in France while I was in Chateau Mirabel with Roger, and he was the one that recorded it. It doesn't matter. What matters is it's the best guitar solo I've ever heard.
Ever. I'm with that one.
Listen,
I've stood next to him, 400-500 times now. And it's
how many great guitar solos can you sing? I mean, how, you know, and you can sing this one.
Well, that's the thing is about David is his melodic ear is always.
The other one is Brick, which of course that was a first hit, wasn't it? That's what the 59 Les Paul in straight into the desk, and there were no chords under it, right? Is that true?
No, there were no chords, and
because that's why it's got this fabulous wrong note in it.
In the end, towards the end. Which I think is brilliant. So
it is brilliant. Of course it's brilliant.
So we added Rick afterwards. And it's not that there were no chords. I think we were just pedaling on the one. And and then Rick started to play that progression on the ending.
So are those Rick's chords?
Yeah, I think, that's my recollection of it, yes. Listen, there were so many, you know how many bits and pieces there were to that record? and how many personalities we had to manage and how, you know, the record company going crazy and all that stuff. And, you know, and forgive me, James Guthrie, but take a fucking chill pill. You know, like there was a lot going on. And if I don't get it quite right, sorry. You know, I'm not killing anybody. You know, my recollection was that Another Brick in the Wall was a first take, and that we had sort of lied to him and said we're just getting levels. I don't know if anybody else remembers it differently, and I don't frankly care.
With most guitarists, they come in and there's some time getting a sound, and there's some time working on a part, and then you work on the sound a bit, and then you work on the part. With David, it's just the sound. And you spend all day, right? I'll go, no, that amp into that amp, then going into that and going, no, that's not it. Okay, take it back from that amp, into that amp, through it to that, no, that's not it. Take it out of that, put that compressor in, put it in that, no, that's not it. And this goes on all day. But then it's like, okay, that's the sound. Roll tape, done.
Done, I know.
The execution is nothing. It's all the sound.
Which is interesting you say that, because the solo on Brick is literally going into the desk, isn't it? I mean, it's DI'd. I mean, was that your idea? Or is it compressed probably on the desk, isn't it?
Apparently we went into it, yes. We went into a compressor, of course, you know, but... because I had done a similar thing with Alice Cooper and with Kiss both, and I really liked the sound of it, so that's what I was going for.
It's great.
On
Gibsons.
Pardon?
On Gibsons as well, because they play humbuckers.
Yes, well, I like it on Gibsons. I mean, I did it on a Strat as well, and it sounded really cool. I mean, it can just, sometimes it can be really, really cool. And... that's what I wanted to hear there. I just thought that it matched the song. Like that whole song was a battle, because, you know, at first the band didn't, I mean, they gave me a verse and a chorus and then they left. And that was it. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. This could be a hit, you know? And Roger says, we don't do singles. All right, then.
Yeah.
So they left. I copied it backwards, as we were discussing, and just edited. It's exactly the same band part, the first verse and the second verse, with a fill that I found of Nick's that seemed to match. And
From somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, it was from working on the song, but it wasn't even a fill. It may have been a part from the verse that I just picked up and isolated and made a fill out of. But whatever, you know, we cut it in. So now we had two verses, except they said exactly the same thing. They had exactly the same melody, and Roger absolutely refused to write a second verse, which I am so happy he did, because what could be better than that kid's choir the second half, right? And and that choir, you know, success has many fathers. So that choir was thought of by, you know, that was thought up by Roger, by Nick Griffiths, by James Guthrie, by me, by everybody and his kid brother. You know, my recollection.
Although you're the guy with the history of it. I mean, it schools out.
I know. My recollection of it was that, you know, when in doubt, get kids. Is sort of my mantra, you know.
Hang on,
careful where you say that these days.
Yeah,
that was Islington Green School on the wall, and my local school actually, the nearest school to me growing up. Although I never went there, I had a bit of a reputation in Islington Green for fighters. But what kids did you use on Schools Out?
They were Central Casting kids from New York. These were professional kids who came with their moms, and
They'd been on Basketball Jones or something, had they, before?
I don't really know what they'd been on before, but they were all dressed properly. The little boys had blazers and their mothers.
Not like the Islington.
And their mothers were doing this and, you know, and this. And then I got
there.
They're
all in fame a couple years later.
And I said to them, I said to the parents, I said, now, look, because this is a recording, you can't.
Where are we? In Islington? Where are we? In Islington?
This is New York.
Oh, okay. Right.
You can't come into the studio. And they were all like, and I said, I have two children of my own. I'm not going to eat your babies. They'll be fine. And so I got the kids alone into the studio, and then we had them laughing. And that laughter at the end of their bridge, that's them laughing at jokes that we were telling each other and stuff. They had the best time. It was so loose and kind of fun. And then they came down running down the hallway like kids, as opposed to professional actors, which is how they had arrived.
Wow. Yeah, we look forward to the court case anyway. Yeah.
Actually, but no, okay, while we're on this incredibly tricky ground, the two words you said to get the moaning and crying on Berlin out of the kid.
Two kids.
Two kids. So, okay.
But there were more than two words. Well, okay. But in Joshua's case, to get Joshua, who was the 18-month-old, it was go to bed. And three words, go to bed.
I thought it was Joshua, bed.
Every night, Joshua was like, no, Joshua, you're going to bed. And he would cry. So that was like, that was clockwork, basically. I brought a Nagra home and I had a nice microphone. I went, Joshua, time for bed. I got that. But the pounding on the door and the screaming mummy, 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 I explained to my older son, David, who was six at the time. And I said, okay, look, you know, I'm recording this and it's a story and the kids are outside, they're locked outside and they're trying to get their mom's attention. She's in the kitchen. So pound on the door and yell, mummy, mummy, mummy. That was it. So David starts pounding on the door going, mummy, mummy, mummy. Mom, mommy, and little Joshua is 18 months old and does everything his brother does. He starts yelling, mommy, mommy, mommy. And actually, if you solo that track ever, you can hear Joshua say to David, I can find myself a mummy. You know, it's like, there she is right there. What are we doing? You know, so, but David was a theatrical kid too. And so he plays a part. But what I did do was I took those two elements into the studio and I put them through an LA-2A, actually, a compressor, and just cranked the gain until it distorted, and it became more and more and more distorted. And that is what gives it that sense of, like, just terror.
It's horrific,
yeah. It's horrific. You can't...
You should have actually had a sort of No Children Were Upset in the making of this album.
Yeah.
You know, he remained a baby for the sake of his career forever. He's the one on Nevermind as well. And Ferris. Oh, God, Bob, we could keep going.
I'm sorry.
But actually, I have a school choir to go to. I have a school concert to go to as it's Christmas. There's
good
a lot of those going on. My son's got one. And I'm going to have to leave very soon. I don't know whether you could talk about this, but you did it. You can, because you recently had a very public spat with Kanye on Twitter. You're not some old geezer who's retired quietly, are you?
And you're standing up for Taylor Swift. I love that. Who you've mixed? Or produced,
yeah, I was. Like. I had worked on the
big Taylor fan
on the Speak Now DVD. I mixed that and the CD that went with it, and spend time with her and with her parents and got to know her a little bit. And I just thought she was a really lovely girl, really sweet. And here's Kanye going, well, first of all, the article is on the front page of the New York Times about Kanye West's never completed Pablo album, right? He's taking it back. Okay. He's already released it. He's taking it back and is working on it again to release it again. And like, I'm old school in the sense that you're going to build something, you make the plans, you build it. When it's finished and you move on. And yes, a year later, you might think that there was something you could or should have done. And maybe you get lucky enough to be able to do a revisit or something like that. But this is a guy who never finished. He just kept taking it back in, and it was really pissing me off. That wasn't enough. It was front page of the New York Times on a Sunday morning, my time, my paper, get out of my face. Anyway, but in that opening three paragraphs, the bottom paragraph, he talks about Taylor Swift and he goes, she owe me a fuck. She owe me an F dash dash K. I made that bitch B dash 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 H famous. And that's when I went into shark mode and I was just, my eyes turned steel gray and I went, he must be stopped. So I wrote like an op-ed, like a little letter that I sent to Bob Lefsetz. And I figured, you know, it's going to go out to the Lefsetz letter. Like they're all probably kindred spirits, you know, it'll go out there. Everybody have a good laugh. I compared him to a lot of people he didn't appreciate being compared to. And I said, he will never, you know, what's his legacy? Like he will never be remembered as much as MC Hammer and Macklemore. Cause I just knew, you know, like if it ever got to him, that would be like, you know, and I did want to stick it to him. I was pissed off at the guy. And I said, his greatest talent was at, you know, at being noticed. He's like, he's like the streaker who runs across the field in the middle of the critical play in the big game, you know? And that's his greatest talent, and that was it. So I did that. I went to sleep Sunday night, blithely unaware that somebody had showed it to him. He was on the West Coast. I was in Nashville. So somebody had showed it to him, and midnight in West Coast time when I was fast asleep, he starts tweeting about it. And it starts off, it's like 12:01:15. You know, who the fuck is Bob Ezrin? Then 12:01:45. It's old farts like Bob Ezrin that don't give ye the, you know, the respect that he deserves. 12:01:55. And it starts getting faster, faster, faster. There's like this string of things. And Bob Ezrin's kids are dying of embarrassment right now because their father didn't understand the power of ye. And ye, I should give Yeezys to all his kids to make them feel better because their father is such a loser. Blah, 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 blah. This goes on like this. My daughter, Sarah, is in Bali leading a yoga retreat. She's the first one to wake up and she's got a ton of text messages from her friends in LA. What did your dad do to Kanye? You know, so she goes on, she looks at the thing. She sees what Kanye says about how they're embarrassed. And she responds to Kanye and says, my father always taught us to meet anger with love and to tell the truth. You're a leader. Choose love. You know, that's my little girl. My son, Jeffrey, who's a lawyer, was in Paris on vacation. He's the next one.
Not on a yoga retreat.
Not on a yoga retreat. He's the next one to wake up and he sees all this. He goes, who's Bob Ezrin? ? His legacy is, and he lists all the artists that I've worked with, all the way down, including Jay-Z, right? Not all this stuff. And then he goes, yours in capital letters is yet to be determined. And then, and so on. And it just goes on, you know, and it's like, oh my God. So by the time I wake up on Monday morning, I have 62 text messages and it's all about Kanye. Then I get called by CNN and CBS. And like at first, it was kind of funny. By Tuesday, I was the number one trending thing on Twitter for 15 minutes. I had my 15 minutes of fame. Thank you. For 15 minutes, I was the number one trending thing in the world on Twitter, thanks to Kanye West. And then by Tuesday night, I was getting more calls and Jan just looks at me. My wife, Jan, just looks at me and goes, that's enough. Shtum.
She knows.
And she knew. So I said, okay, thank you. Yes, I'll shut up now. But I was loving it because I just thought it was, you know, it was getting to him. Now, what turns out to be true is that then when he wasn't getting a rise out of me anymore, then he turns back to Taylor and he turned to Ludacris, I believe, and start taking him on. And the puking out invective got so terrible that Kris Kardashian, mom, took his phone away. So I, you know, and again, James Guthrie will probably disagree with me on this because he was probably there. And, but
Oh, Bob, we love a bit of controversy. Yeah. So you're still out there, you know. That's the thing, isn't it? This isn't a guy that is just like the career ends in the.
I'm still making records. 70s. Why would my career end? You know, until somebody shoots me. Sure. You know.
Not to mention, can we also point out all your other fantastic initiatives, your great education stuff you're involved in, and all sorts. You know, it's
absolutely music rising with the edge.
Yes, and the environmental causes, which is, you know, that's risen to the top of the heap.
What are you working on creatively right now?
I just finished a film with Edward Bertinsky called In the Wake of Progress, which is an environmental project. It's a massive immersive installation. And I just finished mixing a live Alice Cooper thing, DVD, and now I'm finishing up an album called Road with Alice Cooper, or Road or Roadkill, we're not sure yet, and also finishing up an MC5 record, working on a very big three concert tribute package that I can't talk about right now.
It's been such a pleasure having you.
My pleasure with you guys. It's really great to see you again, and it was terrific to see you on tour. It was really wonderful. What a great show. You were both amazing.
It was so great you came, man. It was so great just having your energy around. It was really, really lovely.
Well, next time you go out, let me know. I'll be there again.
Fantastic. I mean, there was some stuff in there.
I know everyone's going to be typing under our social media posts saying things like, you know, there needs to be a part two. What about... And all the Floyd heads are going to be complaining we didn't do all the other albums.
At one point, I thought, do you know what? At this rate, we're just not getting to the wall. We're just not... And we didn't touch on the Division Bell or, you know, Momentary Lapse or any of that.
I've got to go to a choir or something
you
like that.
You go to your choir, mate.
Concert.
That was fantastic. So keep it right here, people. And thanks to Ben, our producer.
Are we around next week? We've got another one coming. I think we have.
We have got another one coming up. We've got a great one next week. Really good one.
We have. See you then. It's good night from me.
And good night from them.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.